I know we're all just trying to stay sane, but today we're going to talk about the brain. Join us today on Fostering the Future.
Welcome to the Fostering the Future podcast, a show about all things child welfare, dependency, adoption, and foster care. Here are your hosts, veterans in the world of child welfare, Jack and Kat.
We believe that every human has incredible and equal value regardless of what side of the courtroom we sit on. We hope that everyone feels welcome and accepted here on Fostering the Future.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook or Instagram as Fostering the Future Podcast, or check us out on our website at fosteringthefuturepodcast.org. This is Jack, and I'm here with Dr. Wallace. And today we're going to get down and nerdy talking about how trauma can affect the brain and body and how that can come out in behaviors. Thank you so much for coming to chat with me today, Dr. Wallace.
I really appreciate the invitation, and I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. So I have a very serious question to ask you. What is your favorite beverage at Starbucks?
Oh, I just got it today, actually. The current seasonal flavor is lavender, so I like to get a lavender lemonade.
My kids love the lemonade there. I feel like Starbucks like makes everything normal better, right?
Yes. What is it? It's because, like, it comes in a bougie cup.
Right. Have you had their brownie or their popcorn?
Oh, yes. And then all those cake pops that are shaped like animals, like, cannot go
super
wrong.
Fun. Jack Jr. was obsessed with the popcorn for years. And I'm like, why are you so obsessed? And then I tried it the first time. And I was like, dang, this popcorn's good. I don't even like popcorn. So Dr. Wallace, can you tell us a little bit about your background?
I have a bachelor's degree in rehabilitation counseling, which is specifically looking at developmental delays in adults, addressing adults with mental health issues, understanding the ADA, all of those fun laws that support mental health in this country. And then my master's degree is in marriage and family therapy. I received that from the University of Central Florida, and I immediately went into practice looking to help families. And specifically, I wanted to help couples because I really care about kids and thought that saving marriages would be like the coolest way to help kids. And very quickly found out that while I do like that work, that there's a strong need for work in other areas. So my practice specializes in mental health, high conflict divorce, situations that are in litigation, that can be any sort of child custody situation, dependency court, dealing with the reunification of children to their parents, post some sort of dependency action. And then I do social investigations, which in the state of Florida is a child custody evaluation under family law. And I do psychosexual evaluations, psychological evaluations, parenting assessments, bonding assessments, independency cases. And I practice in Brevard County, Florida. I do have a PhD in psychology. My dissertation is basically about the therapist and what it's like to be a therapist who is married and navigating marriage counseling. So what's it like to be both a novice and an expert at the same time? Because you can be the expert in the room all day long, but then you go home and you have to deal with your own relationship. So my practice is kind of focused on really supporting the family system, all of the ways the family system can be disrupted or injured, and bringing some sense of understanding, healing, reunification, and really assisting parents, children in having the healthiest developmental time possible.
Wow. That is like a very diverse, but also very focused yes. area of practice.
Understanding that family dynamic and supporting the family dynamic as best as possible.
So we have been discussing behaviors that children in foster care may exhibit, and more specifically, how trauma can be the direct cause of some of these behaviors. Can you kind of give us like a scientific explanation at a layman level, like what trauma is and the ways that trauma can affect a person's brain and body?
Yeah, it's interesting because some of the ways that we define trauma in our culture really fall short of encompassing everything that a person can experience that causes brain changes. So I'm going to start from the beginning with development. Our brains are literally like computers and they're being programmed from the very beginning. Actually, our brains start being programmed in utero. The first stimulus that we start to experience is sound at 7 months gestation. And we start to learn things at 7 months in utero. We start to learn the voices of the people around us. We start to hear the tone and the environment that we're being exposed to. We're also absorbing all of the chemicals that our mother is exhibiting during those interactions that we are beginning to hear for ourselves. So high conflict, high stress in utero itself can create some traumatic impact on the brain and cause some differences in the way that a child will experience life even before they're ever born. You can actually exponentially discuss that too in terms of other things that children in foster care are exposed to, things like drug exposure in utero and domestic violence and things of that nature. So we're starting from the basis of this human being who has a genetic coding that's going to be about 50-ish percent responsible for who they become as a human. And then the other 50% is being shaped by all of the stimuli that they're experiencing. And so any incident at all in child development that leads a child to believe that they are unsafe or that they need to be self-protective in some way for survival is going to have some sort of effect on the body. Because what happens when we have a feeling of being unsafe is our adrenal glands get kicked on and turned on. And our adrenaline starts to pump. Adrenaline is the chemical that is there to keep us alive. It's our fight or flight chemical. It's the thing that's going to make it so that we're whatever we need to do physically in order to protect ourselves, we're able to do.
Is that like when moms can lift cars off their children and get like super strength? That's from the adrenaline.
Yeah, and that's an adrenaline rush. And then what happens after that adrenaline rush is adrenaline then gets broken down in the brain to become dopamine. And dopamine is our learning chemical. It's our focusing chemical. It's really the chemical that's responsible for us not having executive dysfunction. ADHD is a lack of or a deficiency in dopamine. One of the facets of trauma is that once we have that surge of adrenaline, we've kind of programmed the brain and the body to experience levels of stress in a very extreme way. ADHD may not be ADHD. It may be the fallout of having had a huge dopamine flood. Because people who don't have ADHD, they kind of have a dimmer switch. Like they can turn their adrenaline on enough to get them out of bed or enough to motivate them to go and make food or whatever. But then there are other people that only have an on or off switch and they have to meet the threshold of stress that will create enough adrenaline for them to flip that switch on. It's either 0% or 100% and there's no in between. A lot of times my parents will be saying things to me like, oh, well, they don't have ADHD. They can focus on video games. Yeah, because that's 100% because they met the threshold of stress for them to be able to focus. But asking them to remember the routine for getting ready in the morning, that you brush your teeth, you brush your hair, you put on your clothes, you do your socks and shoes, like that type of routine, mundane type of stuff doesn't bring enough stress along with it for the dopamine to be pumping. Any exposure to trauma can create a disruption in that dimmer switch, so to speak.
So when they get the flood of dopamine, so that's dysregulating their future use of dopamine?
It can. It depends on the level of threat that the person is feeling. It depends on how long that threat lasts. You know, when you consider our nervous system, our central nervous system at its very primal, basic level is made to assist us in fight or flight for 20 minutes. The gazelle running away from the lion or the cheetah is only programmed to do that for about 20 minutes before it starts to become very laborious for them physiologically. Consider trauma for a child. If they're watching parents fight for more than 20 minutes, you're now reaching a level of stress that can start to reprogram the brain in the way that it is going to end up addressing stress in the future. What's the level of that threat? Is it watching people fight? Is it extreme violence? Where is the threat in terms of the threshold? Recognizing that any sort of exposure can influence the brain, but really the intensity or the frequency or the length of time can also have a standing impact. Also, when it happens in development, a young child being exposed may or may not be taking in the stimuli or have learned enough to recognize just how much of a threat they're in at the moment. Whereas a child who knows what certain weapons look like and what they do and what they can do may recognize threat through their visual cortex in a much more intensified way than a small child who doesn't quite know yet. All of our developmental processes happening at the same time impact the way in which trauma then affects that individual.
So then you've got the intensity, frequency, and duration of these traumatic or stressful moments, determining the effects that that will have on the brain and the dysregulation of various chemicals that happen.
Yes. And not only that, but then once we start to have this flood of fight or flight chemicals, the whole body gets engaged and each area of the brain is now responding in different ways. So we know that trauma affects the limbic system. Our limbic system is the part of us that is really engaged in whether we have fear or sadness or anger, or whether we have a sense of well-being. So the limbic system kind of drives that sensing that we're experiencing, as well as interprets this sensing that we're feeling. So the limbic system gets ignited, and all of a sudden your hippocampus, your amygdala, your basal ganglia, all these weird brain structures start to get affected. Your prefrontal cortex, which, by the way, your prefrontal cortex isn't even finished growing till you're like 22 or 25, depending on what sex you are.
Oh, which is which?
Females at 22, males at 25.
Because I always say 25 and my kids are mostly boys, so I'm probably okay there.
You have this prefrontal cortex, which is it's the secretary of the brain. It's the area of the brain that's responsible for taking in all of the information, organizing it, and then sending that information back to the other structures of the brain so that the brain then knows what to do. If you're dealing with an immature secretary observing traumatic incidents, the way that that information is going to be interpreted can be affected. Children tend to internalize a lot of the things that happen in their life. And what I mean by that is they make it personal. You'd be surprised how many kids come in here in my office and say, you know, well, if I had just been better, things wouldn't have turned out that way. Or maybe if I didn't annoy them, they wouldn't have hit me, or things of that nature. And the truth is, that is partly to blame for that immature secretary. Everything revolves around me, and so it's all my fault, and I have way more power than I actually have. So you've got that structure being affected, because when the brain gets flooded with dopamine, the secretary goes on high alert. And now she is hyper-focused on gathering data and information, maybe even data and information that doesn't necessarily need to be gathered. So that might look like being distracted by visual stimuli. I'll see a young boy and he'll be sitting having a conversation. The next thing you know, he looks off because something caught his attention. You know, typically in my office, it's like all of a sudden they're looking at the degrees on the wall and they're reading the degrees like, like it matters, right? Like, yeah. I'm Dr. Wallace. That's all you need to know. You don't need to know what date my degree was conferred. But their visual cortex is on high alert because that prefrontal cortex has been flooded with dopamine. And so they're looking around to gather information. And that's because at some point in time in their life, they didn't feel safe. And so cueing, that visual cueing is happening for them. And it's getting in the way of them doing some other things that they need to do in life, like hold a conversation, pay attention to directions, or, you know, complete tasks that are being requested of them.
Which is why a lot of kids with trauma present as having ADHD. Yes. Not that there isn't like comorbidity with it because of the likelihood of someone who's experienced trauma dealing with maybe being parented by someone with substance abuse who is maybe self-medicating to deal with their ADHD, which right. could have been passed down genetically. They might have ADHD, but they might also just be hypervigilant from the effects of the trauma. That's from the prefrontal cortex.
The prefrontal cortex is the part of the brain that's responsible for organizing all of the stuff that the brain is going to do. Imagine some tiny little five-year-old at the front of some sort of executive office telling each executive what they need to do next. You know, it's like the five-year-old doesn't really know. If they do take a stab at it, they're likely to really do it in a clunky or inappropriate kind of way. The amygdala, those areas that are responsible for both fear and anger, that area can get ignited from that dopamine flood. And that is because it's primal. It's actually the area of the brain that keeps us safe and makes some really hard decisions. And when a child has experienced trauma and they get into a new experience that smells or feels or kind of resembles to them to be a replay of what they've had before, they may actually overcompensate or exaggerate their responses because they're not actually responding to the moment that they're in. They're responding to the moment that they're in based on what they know from the past. And so, you know, having the toy on the playground taken from them may feel just as threatening as some of the other traumatic things that they've witnessed or been through. So they hit or they exert power or they might push or do something that we would see as acting out or violent behavior. And we might decide that it's learned in terms of what they witnessed. But really what it is it's really self-protective and survival type behaviors. If we take the behavioral approach and we just try to change the actual behavior, we're missing a really huge piece that needs to be addressed. And that is, there is a very real nervous system response that is happening for the child that is causing dysregulation in the limbic system. There is no reasoning with a dysregulated limbic system.
That's a fact.
Right? So here we are as parents, and we're seeing children have meltdowns, and we just want to stop the meltdown rather than address the feelings of a lack of safety that are happening in the body. This is why one of the theories of development and therapy that I practice is polyvagal theory. And polyvagal theory basically says everything is regulated through your vagus nerve. Your vagus nerve connects your brain to your heart, to your gut. A lot of what happens is based on what you sense, not based on what you think. You start behaving in ways that are really about what you're experiencing on the sensory level. If a parent can actually hijack their own nervous system when they're parenting and bring regulation, bring an energy of safety to a conversation, you'll help to regulate the child's nervous system, at which point in time they're able to do the learning that they need to do because they're no longer in the adrenaline mode. They're now being supported by the dopamine that just got pushed out based on their sensing of threat. But if they're still feeling threatened, doesn't make any sense to start telling them why they did something wrong or how to correct it. Lecturing is like the worst parenting skill ever. If you see your child having a meltdown, recognizing, okay, they're having feelings, big, when I say big human feelings, I mean, their feelings are just as big as you and me. And the difference is they're in a tiny little body with a very new brain. So they got a lot of learning to do.
You had mentioned, I believe you called it the polyvagal system, right?
theory.
Okay. So the only place I have heard this is on TikTok, and it's with people who have like exercises to like reset your vagus nerve. So can you explain that a little better and how the vagal system functions along with the other ones?
So the vagus nerve is like the lizard brain. It's the thing that senses threat. It's that thing that switches on that fight or flight that gets you into the mode that you need in order to survive.
Is it like a physical thing located somewhere in your body?
It's a nerve that runs from your brain down your throat to your heart, and it sits in between your digestive tract and your diaphragm.
Oh, that's interesting.
It like tucks in. The reason why deep breathing, you always hear about that in therapy, like just deep breathe, right? There's science behind that.
Yeah.
Deep breathing helps to massage that vagal nerve, that vagus nerve, because when you use your diaphragm very methodically, it creates a little bit of pressure. And then it lets go, kind of like if you were to have an acupressure massage, right? Like it gives a pushing and then a letting go and then a pushing in a very methodical way, which helps to regulate your heart rate and helps to regulate your breathing and really calms your entire nervous system. Polyvagal theory has kind of revolutionized the way that I see children. I used to think that rolling your eyes was a sign of disrespect, and I believe the exact opposite now.
Tell me.
So rolling your eyes is a nervous system reset. So what it tells me is that the child, they may actually think, you know, I'm full of it. Let's put it that way, right?
They may actually be disrespecting you.
They may actually believe that I'm full of it. But what they're doing when they roll their eyes is they're practicing filtering, saying that to me and expressing that to me. They're actually regulating that nervous system. So I don't see eye rolling anymore as a disrespectful act. I see it as the child doing what they can to respect me, despite the fact that they think I'm full of it.
Okay. And they so think instead I'm of coming of it, at you verbally, they're rolling their eyes.
Yeah. They're relaxing that nervous system. And listen, teenagers think you're full of it because they don't have a working prefrontal cortex yet. That's why, because their secretary of their brain is 5 years old. Like, yeah. Right? So of course they think I'm full of it. They're like, oh, go, mom, you know? Right. So when I see a child rolling their eyes, I'd make no mention of it. I note it to myself. Okay, there's something here in our relationship that's off, that they don't think I'm on their team. Or they don't think I have their best interest at heart. They don't know the things that I know. And if they did, goodness, they would be so thankful for my parenting. They really would. I mean, how many times when we were teenagers did we think we had it all figured out and we grew up and went, holy heck, my mom was right. You know, this person I couldn't stand while I was a teen is now like the most genius person that ever lived. So we have eye rolling. We also, did you know, your vagus nerve runs right down that left side of your throat to your heart. When we raise our voice and we're yelling, it's a regulation tactic that the body is engaging in to try to calm us.
So your child is rolling their eyes at you, they're yelling at you, and they think, oh, I got them. And you're quietly enjoying it, knowing that they're regulating themselves, which is what you wanted to begin with.
Exactly. I'm like, yep, you're feeling angry right now. I get it. I totally get it. I probably would feel angry too if I had your experiences at this moment. But I need you to know that you being angry at me or you feeling that I'm not on your team isn't changing the fact that I'm going to show up and be the best parent I can be. Love you. Mean it, you know, like, so now because of polyvagal theory, I don't see behavior as the problem. I'm seeing behavior as their attempt at a solution.
You kind of have shared a little bit about how it can help regulate, but does it have any play in the negative effects?
Oh, yeah.
And the reason I asked this is because you said it goes right by the GI system. And I know that a lot of people who've experienced trauma have a lot of like lifelong GI issues that it's like, it can't be a coincidence that everybody I know that has extreme trauma also has extreme lifelong GI issues.
Okay, so we're starting to move away from the very like understood area of trauma. And we're now kind of like wading like knee deep into the area that's kind of like the frontier of what we're looking at right now.
Are we adventurers?
Yeah, we are. We're pioneers here. So there's new and upcoming research about the immunological changes that happen in the body related to trauma and how epigenetics gets affected by trauma, and then how the immune system affects the gut bacterias and the way that we end up, you know, believe it or not, we create 70 to 80% of our neurochemistry in our gut.
Oh.
If we're talking about like serotonin and norepinephrine and all of that, if we're creating 70 to 80% of that in our gut, we don't even need to have trauma to be having mental health problems.
We just need GI issues.
Terrible diet and terrible exposure to toxic substances. And please don't get me started on the things we eat here in our country that we don't have the access to in other countries. It's crazy. Backing up to the GI issues. A lot of children who've gone through trauma, their vagus nerve, that entire system is very sensitive and hypervigilant, so to speak. And so a lot of times you'll hear them complain of tummy aches, and it's actually not a quote unquote pain. It is that whirling, scary, uncertain feeling that's happening on the neurological level because they're sensing threat. They're sensing a situation where they're going to be not safe and where they're going to have fear. I can often get this with children who don't want to go to school. You know, they're like, oh, my tummy hurts. And it's not hurt. It's not like they're doubled over in pain. It's actually that they're having those lower neurological flares that are saying like, we don't feel safe going to school. But then also the neurochemistry we're finding, because it's a lot of it is regulated in the gut, is affected, and the immune system is getting affected as well. The immune system connection with trauma and how cortisol communicates to the immune system is one of those areas that's currently being researched. Brain research and the science behind what we do is, it's so new. Therapy started with a guy thinking, if you just talk to me about the pictures you see in your dreams, I'll tell you what's wrong with your life. And really, that was a great place to start, but we've come such a long way. In 2012, a study was published where we found that the pituitary hippocampus adrenal axis, that is another board meeting that happens in the brain. We found it through a rat study. We took a control group of rats, we left them be, and we took an experimental group of rats and we stripped them of their microbiome. We gave them antibiotics, antifungals, and then we observed them. And what came out of that science was that the clean rats that did not have a microbiome were extremely nervous, isolative, reclusive. They sat in corners shaking. They wouldn't eat. They wouldn't drink. They wouldn't socialize. They were afraid of the world. And then all the dirty rats with a microbiome just went about their life and socialized and ate and played and did normal stuff. And that's when we found that there is a connection between what's happening in our gut in terms of our microbiome and what's happening in our behavior. That was 2012. We're talking only 12 years ago.
Wow.
We find this. And that's when all the pediatricians started saying, make sure you take probiotics after your kid gets a round of antibiotics. Make sure you eat yogurt. What they started to realize is that by prescribing antibiotics, we're actually doing some damage to neurochemistry. And we have to make sure that we're replenishing that. So this is like new stuff in the last decade that we're starting to learn how what's going on in our body is affecting the way that we think, the way that we feel, the stuff that we have in terms of the manufacture of our neurochemistry. And if you don't have that, like, of course you're going to be sad or anxious or feel sick or fatigued in some sort of way, because your body can't run without fuel, just like a car can't run without fuel.
This is probably like the physiological proof behind the ACE study, right? Where these adverse childhood experiences that were trauma created like physical, like there's a link in the chain, right?
And there's some sort of link. We just don't know exactly what's happening there yet. And we do know that people who have higher incidence of ACEs have higher incidence of chronic health problems. Well, that speaks to something happening on the immune system level as well. It's interesting because if we see people as only what they do or only what they think, we miss the vast majority of what's happening in their biological universe, because we're not separate from what's happening in our neurochemistry. We're not separate from all of the programming that we had as children.
So we're talking about when trauma happens, first of all, there's a flood of dopamine. Now, what is the difference between the dopamine and what I've heard is the cortisol? Are those different chemicals or the same?
No, they're different chemicals, and they work in tandem with one another to regulate. So cortisol is really responsible for helping to regulate the things that are happening physiologically in the body, making sure the heart rate is sustained, but not too fast, making sure your breathing patterns are happening correctly and things like that. So on that physiological endocrine level.
So when you're in a stressful moment and you're like hyperventilating and your heart's beating out of your chest, that's the cortisol flooding?
Yes. And the adrenaline that's happening. Once the adrenaline is tapped, right? Like either
20 minutes.
20 minutes, or it could be before then. You know, if you get into a car accident, typically that's a one moment thing. And then you feel that crash coming down, right?
Yeah.
The adrenaline goes off. You have that feeling. Then all of a sudden it's like, ooh, that is now the regulation of cortisol with the adrenaline and dopamine. Dopamine is then when you're able to go, okay, whoa, what just happened? How is everybody? What do we do from here? And you go into this mode of like being very hyper-focused on what needs to be paid attention to. Everything else kind of drowns out and you're narrowed in. And there are many other chemicals, endocrine chemicals that are happening at the same time. Cortisol is going to communicate to the brain that you're under stress, but the dopamine is what's actually assisting in some of those thinking processes.
Is it both of them together that kind of changes how the brain and body regulate in the future, or is it just one of them?
I think it's both, because you also get adrenaline from things like going on a run, you know, and going on a run doesn't create necessarily a spike in cortisol. It can, but it's not going to have the psychological effects that you would get when you're experiencing stress.
Multiple chemicals, but the primary ones are adrenaline, dopamine, and cortisol, and they flood. Cortisol is primarily for your physiological reactions. Dopamine is your decision making. Because of these floods, and depending on the duration, depending on how these things affect your brain, it will change the chemistry of your brain in the future, right?
Yes. And not only that, but it creates what we call neural pathways. So neural pathways, if you consider, is kind of like you're in the forest, you take the same route over and over and over, you're going to wear a pathway. That's what occurs in the programming that's happening in our brain during that incident. When we're much younger, when we're small children, it's really easy to create a neural pathway. And then when we get older, because we've learned so many things already, all of the neural pathways that we are making are actually building on former pathways we've already created. I'll give an example. You may believe that you're unworthy or unlovable in childhood. That message gets imprinted. That's something you believe. That's kind of like the running silent subconscious message that's happening, because that's the neural pathway. And then something takes place when you're in your teens. Let's say there's a breakup, or there's some sort of, you know, rejection in a friend group or something like that. That's building off of the neural pathway that you are not worthy or unlovable. You're actually tapping back into that neural pathway. That's why people who have had trauma have higher incidence of issues later on in life. Not because there's just this weird mystical thing that happens that you are having some karmic experience, but rather the way that you interpret what's happening to you is based upon the things you've experienced and believed about the past. So a breakup to somebody that hasn't had abandonment trauma is a very different experience than someone who has had abandonment trauma.
Because you're not reusing some of those neural pathways.
Right.
And when you reuse those neural pathways, what about that is what can create behavior and problems in the future?
If I take that example of abandonment trauma, a lot of people with abandonment trauma will engage in coping strategies or survival strategies in order to avoid abandonment. They will do things like get frantic, become very anxious, and overly scratch at the need for somebody to pay attention to them. While another person, based on their own genetic makeup and experiences, might anticipate the abandonment, and they may push a person to abandon them because then they feel like they have control over what's happening and they can prep themselves and be emotionally on guard and ready and shielded from being blindsided. The coping strategies are really what you're seeing when you see negative behavior. It's coping. And the problem is when we make those behaviors about, you know, whether the person is being willful or whether they're trying to cause harm, we either idealize or demonize their behaviors. What ends up happening is what we're telling the child is the things that you've done to try to survive make you a bad person. And then the child is internalizing even more negative belief about themselves. Whereas if we can see their behaviors as a coping strategy and we can get down to what are you feeling like you need to cope with? And how can I, as your family member, help you to know that you don't have to cope? Because
right.
I'm not going to put you in that position to need to cope. And I can create a sense of connection and safety. I'm not going to abandon you. You can try to push me away, but I'm going nowhere. That message over and over and over, especially when they tease it out, because I'm sure you've seen these kids who are like, let me see how far I can push it. You have to be like, I'm not going anywhere. Like,
why are we making this so difficult?
Right. I just want to eat dinner. You know, what ends up happening is those children will try to see, okay, where is the line? Because I'm really afraid that I'm unlovable and unworthy. And I need to be clear. I know that there are dynamics where families have to create some sort of different strategy or setup for children because whatever that child is doing is a risk to other children in the home.
Right.
I get that. I'm not talking about those situations. I'm talking about the children who are terrified of being let go of. And you just need to get to the breakthrough where it finally sits in their body that the truth is that you're going nowhere. And they won't sense that from you if you're responding out of your own dysregulation. If your own central nervous system is experiencing threat of some sort, they're not going to interpret it. And I'll tell you, when I get down to it with parents, it's normally something along the lines of feeling like they won't be a good enough parent or that the child won't actually accept or love them. You know, this fear that they're going to get in trouble or whatever those fears are, the child sniffs it out. And the problem is you're afraid of being unloved and so are they. And now your fear of being unloved and their fear of being unloved are at war with one another. When really you could say, listen, whether you love me or not, I'm going to love you. That gives them permission then to go, oh, I can love you too. What we have to do when parenting is recognize that all the little things could be affecting our children and try to steer and support and encourage and assist with regulation as best that we can so that children can learn to solve their own problems and grow up to be as happy and healthy as possible as citizens.
I mean, we joke about it because we're like we don't know the science behind it, but kids in foster care get sick way more than other kids.
Yes.
So that is the immune system being affected by, wow.
Yeah. So I worked for 2 years at a residential treatment facility for children. Majority of the population that I dealt with was either in the foster care system or completely ward of the state. We were sick all the time on that unit. And the behaviors that I've seen by those children, God, I mean, it would break your heart some of the ways that these children try to protect themselves. There are things I can tell you that are like, I joke about and laugh about, but I have to do it that way because if I got real serious about it, it would crush me, you know. But all of that, when you recognize that trauma shapes the way a person views and internalizes their environment, you start to realize that this child is not trying to be a handful.
Right.
They're literally in a mode, they're stuck on a merry-go-round of feeling like they need to survive.
If we can just kind of take that perspective when we see these, like, it's not pretty, but when you look at it as them literally reliving a moment where their survival was in question, how sad and how much more compassion can you have in those moments?
If somebody's listening to this and they're not even like thinking about their foster children, they're thinking about their regular biological children, okay, that they've been with from day one. I want to be really clear that children can get some distorted beliefs that even have nothing to do with you. And if you create an unsafe environment for the processing of those negative beliefs, you're actually reinforcing those negative beliefs rather than dispelling them. The hard part about parenting is like the balance between how it affects you and what your child is going through. Like I tend to stay with my kids and I'm like, okay, this is what you're dealing with and this is what your problem is. And I'm able to do that only because I'm a therapist. I'll be real. You know, the first time my 3-year-old said, "I hate you, mommy," I realized I could either show up as mom right now or therapist right now. And I'm going to choose therapist because mom's about to lose her mind, right? Essentially, we as parents have to be willing to sit with our kids to the point where we assist them through it. And then we can talk about how that impacted us. Then we can say, okay, I just need you to know, like when you push me away or when you call me names or when you do this, this is how I'm experiencing that. I can't just act out and express to them without first giving them the floor because their brain is weaker than my brain. It's smaller, it's younger, it's less programmed than mine. I need to keep myself in check as much as possible with a limit in mind, right?
In our previous episode about behaviors and what kind of behaviors you will see, the therapist that I was speaking with was referring to a time where she was working in a residential facility with kids who are in the dependency system. One of the boys there, all day long, every day, this kid was cool as a cucumber, well-behaved. Every so many weeks, he would absolutely lose it, flipping tables, throwing tables, complete dysregulation. She was talking about how they had to kind of like investigate to figure out what the trigger was and why this was happening at certain times. And after some time, they figured out it only happens at dinners. One of the men that worked there suddenly put it together that it was only when they ate fried chicken, saw it happen, the kid throwing tables and stuff, waited till the child calmed down and was back in his normal stable status. And then pulled the kid aside and said, "Listen, I noticed that every time we have fried chicken, this happens." And the kid just kind of broke down and told him about a really traumatic thing that had happened at some point in his history where there was some fried chicken involved. Basically, the way he handled it was said, "Listen, from here on, I'm going to try and keep an eye out for when we're going to have fried chicken and I'll make you something else." I'm sure the child felt ashamed because it was happening in front of other kids, guilty, creating all types of negative thoughts and beliefs about himself. They said that the child never had another tantrum again because they would just change that. Looking at an example like that, this kid had some type of traumatic experience with fried chicken. So when that initially happened, these hormones flooded him, neural pathways get dug. And also, doesn't it sometimes change like the size of some of the brain segments?
Oh, yeah. So the hippocampus shrinks, the amygdala gets inflamed. And when I say inflamed, it doesn't enlarge, it just ends up getting almost like the tissue becomes stressed, essentially. Those anatomical changes, it actually can atrophy the prefrontal cortex as well. Those anatomical changes are like lifelong impacts to the brain. It's not like ebbs and flows and grows and shrinks. No, it like literally, quote, stunts your growth, right?
When you say atrophies the prefrontal cortex.
Yeah.
Okay, so the prefrontal cortex you described as a secretary.
Yeah.
When we say atrophy, does like that means kind of dying off, right?
Dying off, actually so, shrinking in that area of the brain. It means that the potential for you to have that logical center of your brain is actually stunted. It can have lifelong impact. The other thing that I want to be clear about when we talk about trauma is the way that our memory works is not in telling the story. The story is what we do in the moment to string along the stimuli that we have recorded to help other people understand what we went through. That's it, the story part. But what we're actually experiencing in memory is the things that we saw, the things that we felt physiologically, the things we felt emotionally, and the things we believed in that moment. That's it. That's the only thing that the brain records. We learned a little bit about flashbulb memory when all that Brett Kavanaugh stuff was happening. You know, his accuser was saying that she didn't have a running, streaming story of what happened. She just had these flashes of what she said happened. And what flashbulb memory is it's those imagery that you can pinpoint. Okay, something happened and it's connected to what I feel physically and emotionally. So sometimes children don't even know what their triggers are because the way that their brain is recording is not primarily through the visual. Sometimes it's through the physiological. I'll give you an example. I had this child who had never described an incident of trauma ever in his life. And at 12 years old, he sat down to take a math test. That evening, he came home to his family and he said, I need to talk to you about something. And, you know, the family was like, okay, what happened? And he said, I sat down to take my math test and I got this feeling in my body. And it reminded me of a time, and he flashed back to when he was 5 years old.
Wow.
And he basically stated that he wasn't 100% sure, but he was fairly certain that he had been sexually abused. Why? Not because he had been exposed to any sexual kind of content, but because he sat down to a math test, his body had a feeling of dread. That neural pathway was ignited, and all of a sudden, he's back in a moment in his mind where he can see where he is, he knows who's there, and he knows how he feels about it. He was very articulate and very able to say, this is what I think happened. I can't tell you anything more than what I'm seeing in these moments. And he had some descriptive detail that kind of gave the family this idea that, yeah, something probably happened. You know, things like what was going on in the room, what time of day it was. It's really important that when we see a child struggling, that we're not just writing it off as a willful act. They can get a sense of dread over a math test and be reliving sexual abuse. Or they could be having an interaction with a friend and all of a sudden have this feeling physiologically that reminds them of the feeling they had when they were separated from their parent. Those experiences, they're encoded, and they're encoded in just what we see, what we feel physiologically, and then what we believe about that moment. Whether it's I'm not safe, I'm unworthy, I'm unlovable, I am broken, those kinds of messages that come in those traumatic situations. So triggers don't even have to be fried chicken.
Or the smell of something.
Yeah,
like
right.
It could just be like a feeling that you re-experience. That's interesting because I have experienced panic attacks in my life. I haven't had one in a very long time, but I definitely had them in my 20s. But what I have had as I've gotten older is migraines. And when you get auras, that those feelings that you have before a migraine kind of replicate those feelings you have when you have a panic attack. Now, every time I have a migraine and my vision starts going wonky, I have to tell myself, this is a migraine. You know what's going to happen. Get somewhere safe. Close your eyes. In 20 minutes, you'll be fine. You just have to deal with pain. The pain is like a welcome glass of ice water to me because it means the auras are over.
Those physiological triggers that can lead to those feelings of panic or those feelings of sadness or those feelings of dread or fear, all of that can itself be a trigger. Your child might be acting out, and it may be because they got a physiological trigger. Now you're telling them, oh, like, you're bad over a thing that they have zero control over. So careful on the messaging, careful on how we approach it, because we could be creating even more work for ourselves. You know, I hear some older, my parents anyway, they'll say things like, it just needs a whooping. Let's say I did go there. Why would I continue to damage the connection that I have with my child when I could literally ride this out this one little time, sit with them and build our relationship, repair the issue that's going on while still maintaining my authority? I'm not giving the authority to the child, but I'm creating more work for myself in the future if I just go around walloping them, because they're going to eventually be like, I can't trust you. And by the way, it's not a big deal till you put hands on me.
And then when someone's acting in a self-protective way and then you hurt them.
The gentle parenting movement I hear a lot about. That model is a very nice model, but not if it compromises the steering of the ship that parents are supposed to be doing. We need consistency. We need some structure. We need limits and boundary setting. The seatbelt on the roller coaster does not apologize for working. It doesn't. And what kind of person would get on a roller coaster and not double check to make sure that seatbelt works? Yeah. A high risk individual, right? The first thing you're supposed to do is you strap in and then you pull up on it to make sure that it's not going to release. That's what children are doing. And you're the lap belt. Don't apologize for being there, but also don't get tighter and make it more difficult and try to
strangle them. Yeah.
Like, just stay steady and stay consistent.
You mentioned epigenetics. This is actually really intriguing to me because one of the things that we see often in foster care systems is I'll get a kid, and after I start talking with their parent, I come to find out that their parent was in foster care. And then I might come to find out that their parent was in foster care. We actually did a series a few years ago with Judge Lynn Tepper about trauma-informed courtrooms, where she was judging a certain way for most of her career. And then she started to see the kids of her foster kids come into foster care. And then she started to see the grandkids of her kids coming into foster care. And she said, we're not fixing anything. Whatever it is that we're doing when these kids come into care and go back is continuing to happen. So if we're not fixing it for future generations, obviously we need to do something different.
I mean, epigenetics is essentially the changes in our DNA sequencing and the way that we read our DNA sequencing based on exposures that we've had to either chemicals or environmental changes of some sort. And that can have an effect on the presence of certain metabolic changes that happen in the brain, the way that we may metabolize certain things like serotonin. Anyway, like, you can get real nerdy with that. I nerd out on serotonin and quinolinic acid. But one of the things that's interesting that the study of psychoanalysis or psychodynamics looks at is things like object relations theory and this concept that when we're programmed in young childhood, experiencing some sort of relationship rupture or traumatic experience, that we tend to search for that same type of experience subconsciously in present day as an adult. And subconsciously, we're trying to actually solve that problem so that we can prove to ourselves that we aren't the problem. What ends up happening is we tend to marry people that are like our parents or marry people that are like our abusers. And it's because on a subconscious level, we're trying to replay history and fix what went wrong. Remember, I said that children internalize a bunch of stuff and they believe they're the problem. Well, this is like one of those weird subconscious programming things that happen. You know, I mean, think about it like computer programming. You've got some sort of malware that is running in the background and you don't even hear it. You don't even see it happening. But once it finally shows up, you're like, oh, dang. This is kind of that idea, that concept of what's happening in terms of everyday life decision-making. There's some sort of malware, negative messaging that you have about yourself, and then you're making decisions out of that, and you're identifying with the same types of people who molded you into being what you are. So you're actually drawn to people that are like your abusers. And so that's likely what's happening in that trickle-down effect of grandparent, child, grandchild getting into the foster care system is we haven't appropriately addressed and healed the trauma.
So we're looking at three different things here that are causing this. Now we're looking at what you're calling the object. What you're teaching us about the object theory, where we're seeking out to solve that problem. And in doing so, repeating the mistakes of our parents. You've got epigenetics, where you've got chemicals, maybe a certain way in your body because they were in your parents' body, and that has somehow altered the DNA to recreate that. And then you're likely being raised by your parent who never learned how to parent because they weren't parented. So now you don't know how to parent because no one's parented you. You've got the genetic code to F up your brain functioning. And then on top of it, you're trying to solve the problem, which is recreating the problem with the object theory. How do you get out of this? Like, you need extreme solutions to counteract all of this.
So, wow. And that's the thing, you know, like when we deal with families that have domestic violence, cycles of domestic violence, it's very interesting because it takes a lot of rehabilitating for a victim of DV to really get to a place where they can trust themselves to choose an adequate partner. Droplets of water meet in the lowest common place. Your weakest place, the place that you have unaddressed issues, the place that you have not created insight, the place that is your blind spot, that is the place that is going to be dictating who you pick as a partner. If you are not being intentional, giving yourself enough self-love to sit with self and become the most authentic version of yourself, but you're kind of just jockeying and kind of like shadow boxing with the world around you without ever going inward and looking at yourself, then you're really likely to repeat the same patterns. You'll just be on the inverse of it. So your mother may have been abusive to you, and you will find yourself with a man who will be abusive to you. So you're not the mother exactly the same in the situation where children are placed in foster care, but you are repeating the same dynamic cycle. The way that I teach people about object relations and relationships and how they program us is you get molded by your parents, right? Like you kind of punch in, they punch into you, and you become this orifice that they fit into. So when you're seeking a partner, you won't fit together with somebody who is like you. You fit together with the person who is opposite and inverse to you. And you have to heal this part of you before you recognize that what is coming at you and is being attracted to you is not something that's healthy or happy for you.
Probably feels comfortable. It's like a comfortable fit because it's what you've always had.
And one of my favorite sayings when I'm working with individuals, especially in any like dating capacity, is be very careful when another person feels like home, especially if your home life as a child was chaotic. If that feeling of fitting together and everything being right may just actually be the reenactment of the dynamic that you had before. And it can get real heavy when you sit with it. That's why most scientists try to stay in like one little thing. They just want to talk about the immune system, or they just want to talk about the neurochemistry. And here I am. I'm like, that gestalt of what's happening, all the micro pieces that fit together to create one big picture, it can feel really, really big. And as parents, you all are having to shoulder all of that. Kudos to all of you who sign up for this. I have my former nanny. She helped me with my children. Like, she was like the go-to gal. She became a foster parent, and I love seeing her journey on social media. And she's like the perfect person to do fostering. There's a world that you all are dealing with, a heaviness, a darkness that you all experience that you don't like to talk about. Because if you talk about it, people will automatically answer back with, well, just stop fostering.
Or you signed up for this.
Yeah, like that's not the point, right? Yeah. The point is not that I signed up for it or that it's too hard. The point is, why do we live in a world that anybody has to shoulder this? Like, can we become more trauma informed? Can we be the kind of people in public with ourselves and with others where we minimize traumatic impacts to other people? I love what you guys do. And if anyone ever needs any like consultation or anything, I'm happy to provide my services. Contact me. I know I'm across the state from you, but
you do virtual stuff too sometimes, right?
Yeah, I do virtual things.
We're going to have to get a list of your what insurances you take. So
I take several. So
awesome. Well, I want to thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. I learned a lot.
Thank you so much for joining us today. Make sure you subscribe and follow us on social. We hope that you join us again next time and keep on fostering the future.